We often talk in the media and on this show about big issues related to mental health, things like access to treatment, peer support, destigmatizing mental illness. And the world of mental health care relies on individual case studies, clinical descriptions of patients, their symptoms, their treatments. In a new book, our next guest does something different. She shares profiles of people dealing with a diagnosis of mental illness who write about and talk about their lives and the ways they understand that diagnosis. And she looks into wider connections between people, their families, and the societies they live in. In their stories and her own story, she finds that simple categories don't always match up with complicated real-life experiences. She writes, they have come up against the limits of psychiatric ways of understanding themselves and are searching for the right scale of explanation, chemical, existential, cultural, economic, political, to understand a self in the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share a story of you or a loved one experiencing some kind of mental health diagnosis, what did that mean for your identity, for your relationships with the people around you? Did medical explanations connect with you, or did you need more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Aviv is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been writing about mental health for years now, and you start the book with the story of your own experience at an early age, age six, diagnosed with an eating disorder and hospitalized for it. Can you talk a little bit about your story and how it led you to this book?
It was always something that I didn't know how to make sense of. When I was six, I stopped eating for a few days. I didn't really know why. I just was sort of refusing to do what the adults told me to do. And then my mom took me to a pediatrician, and it was the late 80s at that time, and anorexia was sort of a prevalent fear. And the pediatrician thought I had anorexia and told my mom to take me to the hospital. And then at the hospital, I was diagnosed with anorexia, and I was put on this unit of girls much older than me who had also been diagnosed. But, you know, because I was 6 years old, I never heard that word. I had no idea sort of what made people lose weight or not. Like, it was all very obscure to me. And one of the things I'd always wondered was how much it felt almost like I learned to be anorexic because these older girls were offering themselves as mentors to me in a way. And I really looked up to them and admired them. And it was always something, you know, I kind of was able to recover and I started eating again and I moved on with my life. But I had always had this question of like, what happened to me in that hospital? I was there for 6 weeks. And it was hard to know what came first, whether like sort of being given the diagnosis of anorexia in a way reinforced or sort of encouraged certain behaviors because I had like a new identity among these girls for that period of time.
You have a reading for us. Looking at that experience, that of an older girl that you were there in the hospital with for anorexia and what led you on different paths. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. And just for a little context, mm-hmm. You know, when I was writing the book, I ended up learning about a woman named Hava who had been in the hospital with me, and I'd seen her as a kind of mentor. And I went back and interviewed her family and read her journals. So I'm sort of reflecting on this here. At 6 years old, it still seemed possible that I could become someone else through sheer will. Had I stayed in the hospital longer or returned to a less welcoming school, I may have followed Hava's path. Labels aren't so bad, she wrote in her journal. They at least give you a title to live up to and an identity. My stepmom, the most practical person in my family, has told me she was once doubtful that I'd make it to adulthood. I do have certain traits that make me susceptible to fasting for no reason, like an amorphous sense that self-restraint is a moral good. But I also wonder if I ever had anorexia in the first place. Maybe my limited exposure to the ideal of thinness prevented me from wanting it badly enough. To use the terms of the historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg, who has written eloquently about the genesis of eating disorders, I was recruited for anorexia, but the illness never became a career. It didn't provide the language with which I came to understand myself.
That's Rachel Aviv reading from her new book, Stranger to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Can you talk about the stories of other people that you share in the book and the amazing access you had, either talking to people in person or their writings and their family members? What kind of stories were you seeking out here?
I think I was looking for people who similarly felt like they were moving in and out of different frameworks for trying to understand like this period of intense distress. I think, you know, an example would be in the last chapter, I write about a woman named Laura who had grown up in this wealthy community in Connecticut, and she'd gone to Harvard. And when she was at Harvard, she'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And for a period of time, she felt like bipolar disorder was her identity. Like it gave her, it sort of explained everything. Like every time she was sad, every time she had too much energy, it was all sort of channeled through the explanation of bipolar disorder. And over the course of 10 years, she ended up taking 19 different medications. Like every time she would come to the doctor, they would give her something new to try to help her. And at some point she realized that like she actually hadn't gotten better at all, that like none of this like extensive, you know, this sort of new way of seeing everything that was going wrong in her life, it wasn't actually making her better. So she started thinking about like who she was before all of this happened, and like whether there had been, you know, problems in her relationship with her family or her relationship with her culture or her environment that was causing distress that like none of these medications could really touch, because like her illness was being treated purely as like a chemical problem.
I want to go into another story that you share of Ray, a man who was at the center of actually a lawsuit involving the question of what's the right way to deal with mental illness, psychoanalysis at that point versus a biomedical model. Can you tell us a little bit about Ray's story, first of all?
Yeah, Ray is this, it was this really canonical case because in the late 70s, before antidepressants were widely used, Ray was admitted to this hospital called Chestnut Lodge in Maryland, and it was known as sort of the most elite place for psychoanalysis. And the entire hospital was devoted to psychoanalysis. And so he went there and the doctors didn't use medications. And for 8 months, they tried to, you know, like figure out his relationship with his mother and sort of why that led to the problems in his life. He had been a very successful doctor. And after 7 months, his mother visited him at Chestnut Lodge and saw that he'd lost 40 pounds and that he'd sort of completely lost his identity. And she demanded medications, and Chestnut Lodge said no, that like they didn't think that was the problem. So Ray transferred to a different hospital where he was treated with antidepressants. And it was this sort of miraculous like coming to life. Like in the course of 2 weeks, he kind of regained his sense of humor. He regained his love of reading. He kind of came back to himself. And so then he sued Chestnut Lodge for denying him medicine that he said, you know, he in the 7 months that he was denied medicine, he said that he kind of lost like the pieces of his life. His wife divorced him. He lost custody of his children. He lost his position at his job. And the case became this collision between two ways of understanding the mind, like the biological approach versus the psychoanalytic approach. And Ray ultimately sort of devoted his life to kind of getting revenge on this hospital. He felt like the hospital had taken away his life. And so in the book, I draw from his medical records, but also from this unpublished memoir that he essentially wrote for his entire life, because he felt like if he could finally tell his story, he would get some sort of vindication.
And this seems to be a theme in your book and in a lot of talk, I think, about mental health care lately, is that, you know, sometimes we have the one perfect solution. It's psychoanalysis or it's medication or what have you. And for one person, sure, maybe. And for another person, it might be the opposite. That what I really take away from your stories is it's more than either of those, and it's more than both of those. What are you hoping right. people take away to add and understand how much more complicated it is?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, psychiatry is often seen as this binary, like it's either, you know, medical and you use medicine, or it's psychological and you kind of talk it out and you need to figure out your family dynamics. And I think those are two frameworks, and both can be true at the same time. But there are also other frameworks, like, you know, the way that discrimination affects a person's mind, or the way that sort of religious crises can like put you into a state of illness, or help you out of a state of illness. So I think that like there's this idea that you need to find one framework to explain what's wrong. And I wanted to show that like these frameworks are not mutually exclusive, and often it requires many at the same time to sort of help a person like refine their sense of meaning.
We're talking to Rachel Aviv about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. If you are willing to share an experience that this book, this conversation may be ringing a bell about for you or your own family, please do call in. If not, I totally understand. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rachel Aviv about her new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. Rachel, you foreshadowed another one of the people in your book. I wanted to ask you about a woman from the Twin Cities, just across the border from here in Wisconsin, named Naomi, a tragic story. And you had mentioned looking at the impacts of social inequality, of discrimination, as we talk about mental illness. Can you share a little of Naomi's story?
Yeah, Naomi was a young mother with four kids. When she was 21, she basically became convinced that government agents were kind of trying to attack her and her children. And she jumped off a bridge with her two twin sons, who are 14 months old. And she was arrested and put in prison. And the chapter is a lot about, you know, the kind of this dynamic of like she had been asking for help leading up to this episode. And she had often been dismissed, like her, you know, the doctors would look at her and say, well, your life is extremely stressful. So, you know, they wouldn't see her as actually having a mental illness because they thought there were like reasons in her life that she was so stressed out. And then after she was arrested, there was this dynamic of her trying to explain why she had reached this state of crisis. And one of the things going on was that like in her psychosis, she felt like she was waking up to the racism in America and to the experience of being a Black mother in America raising children. And she kind of couldn't see between, you know, like on the one hand, she was having these real insights about the way things work. And on the other hand, it was sort of psychotic in the sense that she lost track with reality. And, you know, once she was arrested, she wanted to plead guilty and say that she was insane, plead guilty by reason of insanity, but she wasn't allowed to because the doctor said like, well, actually the insights you have about the nature of society are true. So therefore this person's not insane. And so she ended up in prison for many years. And the conversations I had with her were about kind of grappling with this confusing dynamic of like, some of the things that were causing her distress were real. And you had like teasing apart what was an illness versus what was distress caused by the way she was raised and the kind of discrimination and trauma she had experienced. And I think that dynamic is really confusing and is one that psychiatrists sort of struggle to weed apart.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sandy is with us in Waukesha. Sandy, hello.
Hello. I wanted to just bring up something that's very relevant about healing. I went to Access Mental Health outpatient in Waukesha County. All the hospitals in the whole county would not take my insurance. So I would have to travel 35 miles for outpatient, and I've only been in outpatient 3 times. And so it's not like, you know, just the access to care. And yeah, people with mental health issues, they do need to tell their story. And that's what outpatient's about. And so I really think more people would get healthier or feel better about themselves if they had better access to care, because it is really a very serious problem.
Sandy, thank you so much for the call. Rachel, 2 things there. First of all, I heard you nodding along to just the difficulties with accessing care. Do you want to touch on that?
Right. I mean, it's like we can have the most amazing ideals of what constitutes good care, but if people can't access it and if our insurance doesn't cover it, then like it sort of doesn't exist. So I think that is, you know, the way that insurance limits care is really profound. And I think a lot of the inability of people to tell their stories and have someone hear their stories has to do with the limits that are placed on like doctors because of the way that the reimbursement scheme is structured.
And Sandy also mentioned the importance of, as you just said, people telling their stories. And that definitely rang with me reading your book. You're telling your own story and you're sharing, as you mentioned, Ray's memoir, Naomi's firsthand accounts, other people's writings over the years. How important is storytelling to helping people find their identity after, for example, a diagnosis of mental illness?
I mean, I'm a writer, so I obviously think like storytelling is extremely important for, you know, our sense of self. But I think that, you know, when you have an illness, it can be a kind of rupture in the story that you have of yourself. And you had certain ideas of who you were and who you were supposed to become. And then a diagnosis like changes those ideas. And I think sometimes that diagnosis can change those ideas in a good way and makes you feel kind of liberated and a sense of relief that like, there's a way of understanding yourself that is generative. But I think other times a diagnosis can feel like someone sort of imposing a story on you from outside, and it doesn't feel right, and it feels limiting, and it feels like you're sort of trapped. So I did think that the people that I wrote about, as they began to recover, it did feel like part of that was like rewriting their story of themselves and feeling comfortable with that and feeling like they owned that.
Sandy, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. We are talking to Rachel Aviv. Her new book is called Strangers to Ourselves. Let's bring on another caller. Rose is with us in Chippewa Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi. I was just calling because I wanted to mention that I'm bipolar, and I had a psychiatrist from Harvard, and he thought he was special and could treat me, and he just did a horrible job, and I ended up getting another psychiatrist that was a whole lot better than the professional Harvard man. And I just wanted to mention that just because they're professional doesn't mean that they're always great.
Rose, thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad you found a better experience, a better treatment, and I appreciate you sharing that. Rachel, the ability to move around and find maybe a different treatment is going to work more for me than maybe somebody else. How important is that to be able to do?
Well, I do think it's interesting that, you know, something that came up in the stories that I wrote were like that we have this idea, you know, that you're alone, you're in a mental health crisis, and you need a psychiatrist to help you. And that may be very true, but sometimes the help that people got wasn't necessarily from an expert. It was like from a friend or from someone who had gone through mental illness themselves. Or, I mean, let me just clarify, like that it wasn't that they, you know, the psychiatrist or the doctor is the only one who can prescribe medicine. But I just noticed that, like, you know, in terms of telling one's story and feeling heard and feeling a sense of like fellowship, I think that can come from non-expertise, that can come from other people who've had mental illness. Or I think for Naomi, like the woman that was in prison, she developed this incredible relationship with the prison librarian. And through that relationship, she kind of felt less alone and felt like she understood her own experiences better. So I think that's like, it's an unfortunate thing that so often like the one person who we feel comfortable telling our stories to is in a position of, you know, maybe not being the right person to like receive it.
Rose, thanks for sharing your story. Rachel, there are a lot of things, I think, to take away from your book and no simple, easy answers. But it seems like one thing that we keep coming back to is the importance of our social connections as mm-hmm. we deal with a diagnosis of mental illness or concerns about it. In our last minute or so, can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I think it's isolation and loneliness that is not just, you know, that really exacerbates mental illness in a profound way. And it's the sense of like finding a community or finding someone who doesn't think, you know, like mental illness can make you feel like you sort of exist outside of the social world. And I noticed that as people recovered, it was because they were sort of being drawn back into the social world through one or another method. And it didn't have to be the same method, but like, it just felt like there was a way in which I think we've all underlooked like how healing a community is.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing these stories with us.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker. She talked to us about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us.